Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Take your recording to the next level with Neural DSP and their unmatched range of guitar and bass amplifier plugins. And right now, you can get 30% off all Neural DSP plugins with discount code GUITARNERDS. Achieve an authentic and professional guitar tone at home without the need for mics or cabs. The Impulse Response Loader allows you to move mics around in a virtual 3D environment. And with a range of plugins that cover everything from crystal cleans and shimmering reverbs right across to crushingly aggressive metal tones, there's something for every type of player. But don't take my word for it, all Neural DSP plugins come with a free 14-day trial with no credit card required. Up your plugin game with Neural DSP and Guitar Nerds. Visit neuraldsp.com for more details. Hello and welcome to the second episode in a new series of the Home Recording Guide. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined by Matt Knight.
Hello there.
Yes, indeed. And in this series, we're going to attempt to make a track using easily accessible, largely affordable home equipment. And we're going to talk you through every step of the way. Now, to preface this, I'll go through the whole spiel that I did in the first episode. To preface this, Matt, like many of you listening, is an accomplished guitarist, but a complete layman when it comes to recording. And until now, this has been something he's left to producers and studio engineers. But with the world in the state that it's in and the closure of studios, venues and rehearsal spaces, Matt, like many of you, is developing his recording skills. So, in this series, as in the first episode, we talked about all the things you would need to get a basic home setup. We spoke about DAWs and interfaces as kind of our primary thing. We decided to go with Studio One by Presonus Studio One, which is the main reason because it's the one that I use, and so it's easy for me to teach that to Matt and then for us to kind of share and build a track between us. Studio One has lots of various versions. There's a free version, dear listener, that you can check out and get. It's very, very good, the free version. It comes with a load of Presonus's own plugins, so you've got enough to build a track straight out of the box, and it's completely free. You can't use third-party plugins with that, but they have Studio One Artist, which is about $100, and that does allow third-party plugins. It also comes with a whole load more stuff, including their range of fat channel EQs and compressors, which is actually still what I use, even though I use, and this was what I was trying to get to, I use Studio One Sphere, which is their top-level one, so you get absolutely everything, plus you get every new plugin or every new update for free with it. Well, you're paying for it. But the difference with Sphere is rather than paying a set amount, you pay a monthly subscription. It's only like 15 quid a month for their all singing, all dancing DAW. And one of the great things about Sphere is it has a built-in work suite, a sort of a workspace in there where you can share, pass around tracks and things like that. So hence why, me and Matt will be building a track via that. Whew. So what we ended up with, that was a big spiel. Actually, I tell you what, it's worth noting because I was on a call with the Presonus Studio One the other week, and they pointed out to me that the artists now, the Studio One artist, which is the one, their mid-level one that you can use plugins with, it comes for free with their £100 interface. So, you know, last week we were talking about interfaces and what would be the best interface to get, and I was like, well, Focusrite Scarlett 2i2 is very, very good, and I still stand by it as an absolute, you know, a fantastic, accessibly priced interface. But the fact that the Presonus ones comes with essentially, you know, £100 worth of software anyway, that's a pretty good place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll have to check them out. It's I think we'll dive into a few of the things from this week. But that's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. Yeah. It's been interesting, Joe Branton.
Yeah. So I sat down to build you. We agreed at the end of the last episode that I'd build you a little backing track to work to for you to add guitars. And of course, we wanted to take advantage of the Neural DSP plugin, specifically the Corey Wong, because it's so very good and so diverse. You get so much with the Corey Wong plugin, as we'll go into. So I had to build you a bit of a backing track. I ended up doing something in 6/8, 75 BPM. And I laid down kind of some simple drums that escalate throughout the track, about a minute 30. So there's no real sort of verse to chorus. There's a slight key change towards the end, but it's more or less just a sort of a slow build throughout, which I thought was the easiest way to kind of showcase this. And I laid down a little bit of bass and I popped some guide synth to it. Now, Studio One comes with this really nice range of Presonus plugins. One of their synthesizers called the Mai Tai has a fantastic preset, which I use for virtually everything, for laying down just the root chords. And it's called 1984. It's got a very Blade Runner-esque, simple sawtooth sound to it. And I simply use the MIDI sort of notation side of Studio One to plan that in. I picked a chord progression and I popped that in along with the drums, and then I wrote a simple bass line along to it and sent that over to you, and that's what you've kind of used. Now, that synth track will come out eventually in the mix, but it was just there to give you like a guide on where the chords were and the notes were and what what you'd be playing with. So I guess before we dive into it, let's give the listeners a listen to the track before we add your guitar. So there we are. Very, very simple. Minute and a half. Bass, synth, and drums. Important to note that I used the Neural DSP Corey Wong plugin for the bass as well. There are, in fact, Corey Wong presets for bass. There's a Precision and a Jazz Bass preset on there, although I sort of messed with it a bit. What's quite nice about the using the bass amps for there is the head, that one of the heads they've designed on the Corey Wong plugin has like a built-in compressor, which I could absolutely crank, and it gives you that old school sort of limited compression, that sort of over the top thing, so that you dig in and it sounds a little bit awkward and like over, like everything squashed into a ceiling, which is what I want.
Yeah.
But yes, it was very simple. Added a little bit of reverb, which I think I'll change. I in fact have changed since then to a little bit of slapback delay, which I used the delay pedal on the Corey Wong plugin as well for that. But that was basically all I used was the same plugin that you used, just a P-Bass going straight into my interface.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things I want to start with before we dive into the recording. A few takeaways, I guess, from that. So I have done almost zero home recording, I would say, you know, in the last 5 years, which we spoke about last time. And this has made me realize how important it is to be able to listen to yourself as a guitar player. Because it's so easy to sit at home and practice and play and, you know, write riffs or whatever, or just play some chords and mess around with pedals. You know, it was eye-opening and scary the first time I heard back a track that I laid down. I was just like, and I won't swear, but I was like, wow. I wouldn't say I'm a bad guitar player, but
what, it really exposes your weaknesses.
Yeah,
is that what you thought?
Yeah, I think so, because well, first of all, you were like, it's in 6/8. I was like, I think I can barely count the 4/4. but, you know, putting the click on, I was like, okay. And then the first thing you notice is there's the intro chords. There's a little bit of silence and then the track comes in. So you were like, I've given you four bars, basically. And how much I was pushing that initial chord. Like I was... Obviously, you know, you can push or pull the track by, you know, being either on the beat, behind the beat, ahead of the beat. And I was like, wow, I'm like really struggling here. And it took me a while to sort of get into it. But yeah, first of all, just exposing yourself as a player.
Playing to a metronome is not easy. And unless you do it regularly, it's, you know, it is a skill in its own right.
Absolutely. And I've always enjoyed playing to backing tracks, and it's something I don't do enough. But first of all, I thought it sort of exposed me as a player. And we spoke about it last time, but that sort of red light syndrome of going, no, that's the one I'm using. Also, it made me realize that one thing I think I've always struggled with, and I think we touched on this last time, was you look at the end goal and you go, I want, you write a chord progression and in your head, you've got this amazing finished track. And then you lay down the first part. And then after about 2 hours of messing around, you're like, this sounds terrible. And you just give up. And you realize there's such a process of refinement in that. And the backing track that you sent me, first of all, I was like, oh, it's a pretty good backing track. You know, you could use that and then we just lay guitars and we're done. But actually, the fact that you can go in and you can, you know, with plugins, you can change how things sound and change the track, and then you can take the synth off and you can change the parts. But I think as a guitar player, and you probably find this as a guitarist and a bass player, but being able to lay down a scratch track easy enough that you can play along to and play over and refine the song. You know, so often I think in the past where I've gone wrong is I've gone this great chord progression. I was like, right, I've got a little drum machine. And then that simple drum machine goes round for a minute. And then you're like, you record that in and you're like, God, this just sounds weak. And again, it puts you off and it's disappointing. And I think, I mean, I know obviously you've had a lot more involvement in bands, but just drum tracks, and I think the availability of things like Session Drummer or Easy Drummer or Tune Track or whatever, where you can drag and drop real drum loops in and actually really quickly create a wicked drum track that's just got a bit more of excitement that you can actually play to. You know, there's that build in the scratch track where, you know, things are building up towards the end. If you were using a drum machine, it would be the same four bars over and over, and then you're just like, you know, I think you actually need the drums in there to build some excitement into the track to play along to, and you might change those at a later date, but I certainly felt that having that sort of backing track helped me create some more interesting parts, create some variation in parts, create different ideas. And actually I laid down a few rhythms then laid down a lead and then was actually took some of the rhythm parts out and put something else in. And once I started diving into it, I mean, hours were lost. In a good way, obviously, but it was just like, man, it's, you know, why haven't I done more of this? And actually, I listened to it again today. I spent a good 4 hours or something on it yesterday, and then the end of the evening, my computer crashed, and I thought I've lost everything. I was like, I haven't saved it. Thankfully, Studio One sort of like automatically saved a bunch of it anyway, and it made me re-record the lead part again. But I came back to it and listened to it today, and I was like, oh no, I'm pleased with that. It feels like a song is forming, and I started getting into it. It's like, right, the lead track, which I guess we'll play maybe after this little bit of talking, yeah. But I found myself, because their space is dropping in, so actually the lead track that you hear is actually four different parts or takes that I've sort of like dropped in different bits, because I was like, oh, I can change this bit here or that bit here, and then left enough room for in the third episode when you're talking about mixing and fleshing things out, that you might be able to drop things out, or you might send it back to me and I might put a different part in. But it was a fantastic experience, and Presonus was a great way to do it. I think it was, again, diving into a DAW for the first time. You know, bits of it felt familiar. You know, I'm not an absolute newbie. You know, I've hit record on a DAW a couple of times. And, you know, I could find my way around quite easily. But it was good. It was good fun. It was frustrating. It was a bit scary. And you know what? I think doing this podcast and putting those tracks out there is kind of a bit of a confidence boost, because I'm just like, yeah, you're sort of drawing a line under it and you're going, yeah, that's the part I'm going with.
Yeah.
And he's putting yourself out there as a player. And I think that's one thing that's always put me off recording. It's like, is it ever going to be good enough?
Yeah, yeah, of course. I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head when you talk about being able to lay down scratch tracks. It's kind of I think it's a learning curve, and it's something to get over when you use a DAW, but nothing has to be finished or the final article ever if you don't want, you know, not until much, much further down the line. And I like being able to add stuff and be like, this is okay, maybe there are a couple of things there, but then I won't immediately go and change that. Maybe I'll start working on something else, like another part of that track, and I'll come back to the instrument or the bit that I was concerned about later. And you can, you know, that, and I think that the constant, that's what gets you over that red light syndrome, is understanding that it doesn't have to be finished until you're happy, and you don't have to get it ready right now. You can keep on chipping away at it. And I think that takes a lot of the pressure off for me, certainly as a player.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, because one of my favorite songs of all time is Sledgehammer by Peter Gabriel. I think it's an amazing song. I've got some good memories tied to it, and obviously I think it's an incredible production. And I think Peter Gabriel was spending, like, the reason he built his own studio is so he didn't have to pay for studio time, because most of his albums took about 5 years. You know, in constant production, you know, he would hire producers that would be like, oh, I'm in this for the long haul now then. And I think you're right. I think, and I'm sure as you get better, you speed up and you can do things quicker. But it's interesting, you know, so many YouTubers out there, like Rabia, for example, you know, and he'll demo a pedal and he'll have a track to go over the top of it. And you're like, how did you get from like a pedal demo to like this amazing track? And I'm starting to slowly uncover the mysteries and the secrets of like, oh, you can like get these, you can basically create an amazing scratch track, a backing track, play a guitar part over the top, refine it, and you don't have to be an incredible drummer or an incredible keyboard player. There's things that can help you do that. And some people say, oh, that's, you know, cheating, and you know, it's not like the old days. But I think it's amazing to give more people the opportunity to make music, I think is a great thing.
Yeah, I completely agree. Now we should play what you've added, because we want to talk about that and talk about the plugin and how we made that work, yeah, and things. I mean, very briefly before we do, on the idea of the scratch track, the bass part that, you know, listener, you've just heard, I kind of played that in as one, like I basically had a stab at that maybe three or four times, and then I listened back through and picked my favorite one and was like, yeah, that one. And I'm sort of, I remember when I was playing that one in, there was like a delivery van was pulling in, and I was sort of looking out the window at that, being like, oh, I'm gonna have to go in a minute, as I was recording, and like a couple of the feels were a little bit off. But also I noodled a lot because my mind was only half on it, and that's why the bass part is so feel heavy. Now, like a bass line like what I've written was fine when it was just the synthesizer and the drums there, because there's nothing else going on. But as you start to add more stuff, the bass starts to interrupt a little bit with the other things, or just kind of get lost, or basically more or less not do its job quite properly. So what I'll probably do after Matt's one is refine that bass part a bit. But that's again the beauty of doing it this way. Anyway, let's play the track as Matt sent it to me on top of the existing bits that I provided. Here it is. So there was, there it was, two rhythm guitars and a lead guitar, plus, you know, a little chord swell for the intro there. That was all the Corey Wong Neural DSP plugin. What did you use? How did you find the plugin? Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so this, let's be honest with myself, be honest with the people listening. I know the term plugin. I've seen plugins. I've never used a plugin, and most of them are a complete mystery, but I nod my head. It's like that meme of someone's like, you know, everyone knows what, you know, I think it was about MIDI. It is like, by this point, I'm too afraid to ask. Do you know what I mean? Everyone's talking about MIDI. Everyone's talking about plugins. I'm like, I'm sort of too afraid to ask, you know, because there's so much out there about plugins at the moment. And what you can do, and you know, I see my mate who owns a studio, and you know, he'll do loads of stuff on modular synth, and he's like, yeah, let's slam a bit of Valhalla reverb on that, and then he's tweaking some stuff. I'm like, I have literally no idea what you're doing. Like, how does it even work? Like, a pedal plugs an input and an output and then into an amp. So it's interesting because me and you, we loaded up Presonus. He talked me through here's the button to record, and here's how you add a new track. And I was like, yeah, that's great, cool, that's easy to understand, and hey, you can color code it and you can name it. I was like, okay, that's cool. So I was like, a plugin. He's like, right, okay, so you've got your plugin activated, you just drag and drop it onto the track. I'm like, what? I'm like, what? How does it work? And it's like, oh, it's basically you're just adding an effect to that track. And I guess this is something we'll cover in later ones. People always talk about, you know, oh, you've got to have a compressor on the bus track. I'm like, what's a bus got to do with it? Do you know what I mean? It's all that sort of stuff. So,
millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I thought what was great as a complete newbie was you were like, right, so you've activated it. So when Studio One loads up, it will load in and it will know that there's that archetype Corey Wong can be loaded in automatically. How it does that, I have no idea. But you were like, you go to the browse window, and I think it was under like VST or whatever. It's like Corey Wong. It's like drag and drop it onto the track. Drag and drop it onto the track. And all of a sudden, this amazing UI-looking UI comes up. And my guitar just sounds way better. Because I'm playing it before, and I'm like, this is obviously the DI track. You know, I'm going into a... I've got a Behringer mixer, and then that goes stereo out into... the interface. And the reason I do that is because I've got drum machines and stuff, and it saves me plugging just one thing into the interface at once. And then, yeah, turn it, and then it was like, oh, I've got all this delay and reverb. I'm like, oh, that sounds great. And just sort of started scrolling through the presets. And I was like, oh, it's much louder, but obviously I'm not clipping the input or anything, because the input into the interface is the input into the interface. It's just not a dry DI sound. And then obviously... a good UI, it was just, you know, this is how you do it. This is, you could clear a little picture of an amp. Oh, that takes me to the amp. And then you can just drag the knobs up and down, and four pedals, you know, they're all, do you want to click the button to turn them on, turn up the compression level or whatever, you know, very, well, the term is obviously WYSIWYG. What, you know, what you see is what you get. It was very much like there's no menu scrolling or deep diving, or it's on the screen. You're looking at the pedals. And everything was in the right order. You know, you've got your, I think it's pedals, you know, amps, then there's a little EQ,
you
like
have a
head.
Separate, yeah, you've got a separate EQ head, which is quite nice.
Which I thought was cool. And then
cab your and mic placement.
Yeah, and I actually did mess around with the mics a little bit. And just until, I mean, again, I don't really know what I'm doing. It's like ribbon, condenser. I'm sort of like... I sort of know what these microphones are, but
yeah,
you know, I didn't really mess around with the mic placement, because it's one of those things where first time you get into pedals and you're like, I put everything at the extreme, and you're like, well, this sounds good, until you revert back to the previous settings and you're like, wow, that sounds way better, because you just you know, you've put things like 100% off axis or what, you're basically pointing it at the ceiling. So I just flicked through a couple of different mic settings, and I realized that a couple of the presets I were using only had one mic on. I was like, oh, I'm going to turn both on and I'm going to set it to stereo, and just sort of played around with it until it got to where I wanted it. And I probably spent about 45 minutes sort of dialing in the first rhythm track. I had an idea in my head. But what was interesting is I actually cycled through a couple of guitars. It's the first time that I've had to pick a guitar for a track. You know, obviously I'm lucky enough to have 10 different guitars here, but you know, that playing at home with an amp, you're just like, oh, I like the feel of this one and the sound of this one. But it's a totally different ball game when you're recording. So I had the harmony out first, and I was like, oh, it sounds good. And I laid down a track, and I'm like, oh, it's a bit dark. And I couldn't really dial that out of the preset. And I'm like, that's because maybe the guitar isn't doing what I needed to do. So, you know, tried the Strat, and I was like, no, that's not quite right. And then, you know, plugged the Music Man in. And I was like, okay. When I'm playing through an amp, I use the neck pickup loads. But actually for this, I was like, no, I want the bridge pickup. It was a bit brighter. It gave a different feeling to it. So it was the first time I've really picked a guitar for a track. And I know there's probably some people going, well, that's crazy. Why have you got 10 guitars then? I'm like, well, it's just, you're a guitar player. You like owning guitars. It's the first time I had to like pick one for a reason. But it was good. I found the plugin. I'm just going to Studio One for a second. I found Studio One really easy to use because I'm only using the top level basics. You know, I managed to set the metronome. You told me how to turn the metronome. I worked out how to tweak the metronome. So I had a slightly different beep on the one. But the plugin was easy because it was what you see is what you get. And I could quite easily dial it in, and obviously dialing amps in real life.
As kind of a brief overview for the listener, that's the great part. There are several screens on the Neural DSP Cori One plugin. So you get your amp head, as Matt said, with all the controls that you can tweak. You can flick through different amp heads. You have the cab, which you can select different cabs and select the mic placement on there. Then you have an EQ head, which is just, I can't remember how many bands, just lots of bands, little EQ heads, so you can fine shape your tone after it's come out of the pre and power amp simulation from the head itself. And then you've got your effects pedals on the floor, which it's split into two screens, normal effects and then time-based effects. So you have a compression, two levels of drive and an auto-wah, because it's Cori One, as your four normal stomp boxes, and then a delay and a reverb, both very Strymon-influenced style delays and reverbs.
You know what? I liked having less choice. That sounds crazy for someone like me who's got like an ungiggable rig, but it forces you to think about what's in front of you and use the tools at hand. And you realize that there's a lot you can get out of that. I thought the time-based effects were very good. I liked the fact that you could sync them really easily. I thought the reverb sounded really good. And then
the reverb is especially good. For me, the reverb is a real strong point of the Cori One plugin.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, turning the shimmer on, I was like, oh, this thing sounds amazing. And then, you know, building other tracks and then having two or three versions of that. On a side note, as we spoke before the podcast, Joe, that I think it's pushing the limits of my computer by running three tracks with the plugin. It's running at about 50% processing power, and every so often was like, no, I'm not happy about this, and, you know, would jump or, you know, the track would glitch.
So there is a little trick to that, and there is something that I should tell you and our listener. If you were experiencing that, if you're using rather heavy, if your computer's a bit slow or you're using plugins that are quite labor-intensive, the guitarist in Polymath uses quite an old PC to record everything. And what he does is when things start to lag, he gets the track as good as it can be. You need to mute the other tracks to sort of, you know, reduce the lag, gets that track to kind of where he wants it to be, then he exports the stem with the plugin printed onto it and then re-imports that WAV now as an uneditable WAV, so he no longer has control of the plugin on it, but the WAV is much lighter and easier for the DAW to read.
I guess we should touch on that actually before we move on to a couple of other things, but it took me a while to wrap my head around the fact that the plugin itself, so if we take Cori One and we're taking a guitar track, when you record that guitar track, you're not actually recording the sound of the plugin.
Not until you export it, no. The plugin is processing it real time every time you play it back.
Yeah, and that was a bit mind-blowing.
But that's the beauty of it, because it means, you know, every time someone records into a real-world amplifier or even plugs direct in through a real-world amp or something, if you want to change that tone afterwards, the most you can do is re-EQ it. In fairness, a lot of what you're going to want to do with tracks in post is just EQing. But the fact that you can, after you've recorded that in, change anything about any of those plugins. Like the fact that I switched from reverb to a slapback delay on my bass track. You know, it's very handy to be able to do that after the fact.
Yeah, I think one thing I didn't do, which I might go back and do a bit more and might just sort of mess around with it a bit more, is play back the track muted in real time and actually edit the sound. I think I spent a long time dialing in the sound to then record. But right. Actually, what I should have done is probably got it roughly where I wanted it.
Yeah.
And then gone back and changed it and looped sections. Absolutely. And gone. Because what I was doing was I was playing it in. I was like, oh, is it clipping? Is it the right drive level? Messing around, back, forth, stop, start. And then was just like, you know, and I dialed in the sound. But ultimately, the plugins allowing you to sort of mess around with that in real time. And it didn't click until the... I was laying down the lead track, and at one point I had quite a different delay sound to what you heard earlier in the episode, and then sort of hit stop on the recording, but the delay trails kept carrying on, and then nothing was recording onto the track. And I was like, of course, it's processing a DI signal. And actually, if I muted, and I think at one point I did turn the plugin off and was like, oh, right. And it sort of suddenly, yeah, started to click into place. But I thought that was really interesting and opens up the conversation about reamping and stuff like that. And, we talked a lot about that before when it came out, you know, whatever, a year and a half ago, and the tube amp expander and recording your valve amp at home and then actually sending out audio over MIDI and reamping it. I was like, oh, man, like... That opens up a whole other ball game, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things, and this is something we'll more come onto in the next episode where we're talking about filling out the track. But you know, things like I asked you to send me the guitar tracks, both printed with the plugin on, so the WAVs with Corey Wong, and just I asked you to re-export them with the plugins turned off, so I just get your raw DI signal. Because one of the things that I will start to do is kind of try to give a little bit more clarity to your parts by I'll run your dry parts through like a simple low gain amp plugin, probably pretty dry, pretty reverbless, and then put them quite low in the mix, and it almost acts like a blend control, and it gives everything just a little bit more of just a little bit less wash and just a little bit more makes it work with the drums, makes it click in a little better.
I think don't want to skip too far forward, but one thing I was watching the other day, which was Andy Wallace, who I think was the engineer on Jeff Buckley's Grace record, and was talking about the guitar sound. And actually, they recorded the guitar sound and mic'd everything up, but then they blasted the track into a room with microphones in just to capture the sound of the of the room and stuff like that. And you know, people are doing things like that, and it's like there's a whole other world. But I think it was interesting, because then I was starting to go, oh well, you know, if I'm, you know, maybe if I was doing stereo parts or if I was doubling parts, you could do different tracks, like you say. You could then have the DI signal, you could add some reverb to that or whatever. And it started to make me think a little bit more about, again, that getting the part right rather than getting the sound right, because actually you can go back and change that, unless obviously you're miking up a guitar amp. And I know in the last episode I spoke, oh, I prefer doing everything on headphones. I started doing that, absolutely, and it was working. And then at one point when I was listening back to the track, I was like, oh, I listened back to the track on monitors. And I was like, oh, well, the lead part's not right. And I just played it in again. I was like, oh, actually, I am starting to grasp that way of hearing guitars through monitors. And then basically highlighted that I probably should have some better monitors. But the only one thing I did find weird, that maybe this is something that other people might find, maybe you know the answer to, Joe, just quickly, is my interface has a mix control on it, which I think is for the monitor. So one side says, or in the middle it says mix, one side is input, and then one side is playback. And at one point I was getting quite heavy, like doubling, where it felt like obviously I could hear the DI signal, but then also the playback of the track. And I was like, I don't really know where I'm supposed to set the control. Am I supposed to set it to input and then just hear what's going in? Am I supposed to set it to playback so I can hear what's coming out? Because I guess when you're recording in a studio, you're monitoring on headphones. I don't really know, but that was a bit of weird, a thing that sort of threw me off.
I don't know either. It's not like I just have a simple monitor control on mine.
Yeah, so I don't know whether that was just the way that it was monitoring or not. But eventually, sort of, I set it to full playback, and it was fine.
Yeah.
It was an interesting experience using plugins. Like I said, I've never been the biggest advocate of plugins before. But now I'm sort of starting to understand that.
You've hit the nail on the head. The advantage for me with plugins is that you can look at them after the fact, that you can continue to mess around with your tone and try and refine it afterwards to an extent that you just can't using other things. Now, we were going to talk about the other options you have for kind of recording guitars in, because you don't have to just use plugins. Obviously, we're talking about home recording, and as we touched on last week, I just don't think there is a reasonable way to mic up a guitar well in a home situation. Maybe for some people there is, but with the state of direct recording these days, whether you're going out of a Katana, a GT1000, or a Helix, anything like that, the direct in options are fantastic. One thing, I don't think I even mentioned this week, but something that I use a lot, or maybe I did mention it last week, the Two Notes Captor X, which has all their cab sim technology. I often use that alongside a real world head in order to be able to capture that. And I actually think Two Notes make the best cabinet simulations. So that, that, and such a broad range as well. So that a wonderful way to kind of refine your tone. But, then the downside of using Helix or something like that is you are married to those tones that you recorded in with, because it's an outworld, a real world piece of equipment. You've just got the WAV on your DAW. There's nothing you can add effects to it, certainly. modulations you can add, but you have to bear in mind that you're at that point, you're adding them, post cab, as it were. So it's definitely more limiting.
I think, one thing I'd like to do is I'd like to try something like, I've got the GT1000 and the GT1000 core here, but is actually record over USB and use that as the interface and try some reamping that way. I'd quite like to try diving into some IRs and understanding a little bit about IRs. I remember watching a vlog on That Pedal Show a while ago where I think Mick was talking about recording stuff at home. And, it can be done. I think if you've got a decent knowledge of mics, you've spent the money on mics, you've got the option to at least give your amp a little bit of oomph, push some air out. I think it can be done. But like I said, I think for most people, the most sensible option is using some plugins and, even stuff like, one thing I find amazing, I'm a fan of Chris Buck and his channel, and he does a track at the beginning of every video he does on a Friday. And that's all generally, I think it's all just guitar rig. It's just like, man, realistically, you can never tell. And ultimately, give any guitarist the choice, they would always want to record in a nice studio with some cranked amps. Who wouldn't want to do it like Joe Bonamassa and have like 10 vintage dumbles and go to a studio and crank it, of course.
That is true. That is definitely true. But I will, even as a vintage gear fanatic, so every time I go into the studio, now with my band, we always use the same studio, Brighton Electric Studios, and they do have, they have an old amp, which I've used for everything Polymath have ever recorded. And it's an old Fender Bassman 100, and they have a 215 cabinet. And I use that every time. And the thing is, it's my vintage gear fanaticism that makes me use it. And even the other week, I was listening back to some stuff. And even when I've been in the studio, I've heard the bass recorded and I've been like, oh, actually, it's getting lost a little bit. It's maybe a little woolly. And everything that has to be done to repair it is not the amplifier, it's the engineer using a virtual EQ, to try and repair the bad choices that I've made that I have to live with on that amp head. And that's the thing, like, you know, as soon as you're using a plugin, you're not actually married to any of those things. But also, even outside of the plugins thing, on the Polymath record, the two Polymath records that we've recorded in lockdown, I've used nothing but, for my bass tone, the Boss GT1000. And the thing is, I'm the tone that I've designed, the preset that I've built, I am 100% happy with. And crucially, in the difference between that preset on that unit and wheeling an amp with valves in it into a glass booth in varied temperatures to use, is that I don't know exactly what that rig is going to sound like. And I don't know exactly how it's going to be recorded. I don't know what mics that producer is going to use this time, how he's going to place them. There are so many variables there. Whereas that preset that I've got saved, I know exactly what it sounds like with my 1969 P bass. And I know that I love that tone. And so I'm kind of like, I wonder what will happen the next time I do go into a real world studio. Will I want to use that old gear, or will I want to have a reliable sound that I have no problem with? There is nothing I don't love about that tone that I've built. And I guess it really depends if you can do that. Like, if you think you need the real world amplifier, if you're unable to, with plugins or digital equipment, replicate that tone, then I totally get it. But if you can replicate it, surely at that point it's a better option.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's just amazing what you can do at home. Do you know what I mean? It's just you know, or even in a studio, or what people can do, you know, to, I mean, you've got to think, like, sure, you could drop in when you're back on tape, but I know when we shot the when we did the Next Tone video, we wanted to record all the examples to tape, but of course all of that tape gets bounced into Pro Tools anyway. But you've had to have an engineer that's like literally like noting every timestamp on the tape and, you know, dropping stuff in. It's, you know, but now you can have a track and you can drop in at any point and just change like one note. It's and you can alter the tone. It's, yeah, I think it's pretty amazing. I mean, I would still love to be able to crank stuff up. I mean, when we released the Box 40, we did 6 amps in the studio, just cranked. But then again, you're still hearing everything through monitors unless you're in the room, you know, and that's different to hearing things through a speaker cab. But I think this is good. I'm hoping, you know, and as next week we talk about virtual drums and building drums, that it will give me a chance to then go away after that episode and actually drag some drums in, and we'll try some different drum programs and actually try and create a backing track of my own and try. Yeah. I just want to understand the magic behind creating a drum track and trying to create, you know, something, because I can't play drums, you know, my fills would literally be like dun 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 dun. Do you know what I mean? Or like,
but as long as you understand the principle of a drum kit, you can program them in MIDI. As long as that, I think the and this I was taught by a drummer, is if you understand the physical limitations of a drum kit, then you can program them well.
Right.
As in, you know, never program in anything that a human can't do.
Right. And okay. And
you'll be able to do it with a good drum plugin. You'll be able to do it. You're absolutely right. Next week we're gonna talk about drums, how I built the drums. I probably did a bit too much on the drum track I sent you, because I did actually even master those drums a little bit as well. We'll talk about sort of the drum track. I think, and we'll go into, I haven't done any of this yet, so I don't know, but I'm thinking, like, off the top of my head from hearing that, you've got a couple of rhythm tracks. I want to pan those out quite a lot. I want to add some rhythm guitars underneath that are a bit drier to give it some more context. I can kind of hear an acoustic guitar it playing along, just some like rhythmic chords, where really what you hear is sort of the pick attack coming through the mix, because it's got something Pink Floyd-y about this track, and that's kind of something that they did a lot. You always had that Martin sort of with open chords in the background of everything. So I might add a little bit of that, and then I'm going to take out that synthesizer, which of course, listener, you couldn't really hear after Matt had added his guitars. I'm going to take out that synthesizer Add in, I'm going to maybe try playing in some piano because I can kind of hear some big piano chords in this, but it might be too much with the acoustic guitar, in which case I'll just put in some more complex synth that accents the guitar a bit better. And there are a couple of things. There was like a little run that you did on one of your rhythm guitars that I'd like to duplicate with the keys and also with the bass. So I'll replay the bass in a few less fills and a bit more in line with what you're playing. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think that's sort of initial thoughts, basically.
What was good is this the first time I sort of like, and I understand now how people can do session stuff at home because I can just get sent all that and drop it in and just export the WAVs. It's like, there you go. It's like, you don't even need to go to the studio to do a session. But it was so good to have that backing track and actually play to a backing track rather than, you know, nothing. And what I'd quite like to do is get some drum loops, get a drum thing in there, so at least I know what drum pattern I've got, you know, because before I think, oh, well, I want to have an intro that goes on for four bars, and then, you know, what I want to do is just drop some drum loops in and then just like a basic chords, then play some bass over it, then do the final guitar track, and then reverse back all the other parts. Do you know what I mean? I don't know how you normally work when you're recording that way, but it feels like everything can be basic, and then the guitar should be laid down in full, and then you kind of reverse everything from that. But
that is, I think that's a really good way of doing it. Yeah, getting everything in as a guide. And then what you'll do is you add the guitars in full, and you'll go back to the other instruments, you'll change them, you'll add them, and then you'll probably, something will happen in one of those that will make you want to go back to the guitar and change something. It's constant building. It's just constant changing and building and developing, and that's what makes it such a wonderful experience, because you are always, everything you do is going to make this better from this point, you know. At some point you might feel that you've done too much, and then you can take some stuff out, but you can just, it's that wonderful process of development which makes home recording so much fun. That's pretty much all the time we have for this week. So next week we're going to be talking about fleshing out the track. So I'll take this away, and I'll come up with some ideas, and I'll add some bits and bobs. And then next week we'll be able to listen to that. We'll play Matt's version again, and then we'll play what I've done to it, and we can talk through what I've done and how to do it. And so how you can do that, dear listener, if you're using the Neural DSP plugins or the Studio One DAW. We'll see how we get on. Exciting times, indeed. But yes, thank you very much, dear listener, for joining us on this journey of home recording. You can, of course, catch us over on our Patreon at patreon.com/guitar nerds and join the discussion on our Facebook group, the Guitar Nerds Group. We'll be back next week with more of this guitar nerdery. Farewell.
Bye-bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.